You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Jeffrey Kine, Shift in Action team member at IONS, and I welcome you to this week's live teleseminar. Tonight's show is Transformation in Action with our host, IONS Associate Director of Research, Cassandra Beaton, and we are delighted to welcome her guest tonight, Daniel Siegel. We will have them in dialogue for about 40 minutes on the neurobiology of interconnection, and then we'll open it up for questions from our members who are on the call with us. I just want to remind everyone who's speaking on the line tonight to keep your voice loud and clear as the call is being recorded for release on the web. Cassie, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Jeff, and welcome, Dan. How are you?
I'm doing great, Cassie. Thanks for having me.
Good. Well, I know are you in California at the moment?
Yes, I am.
We're just having such great weather out here, isn't it?
It's lovely, yeah.
It's been good. Well, thanks so much for coming on. I want to introduce Dan to the listening audience. Dan received his medical degree from Harvard University and completed his postgraduate medical education at UCLA with training in pediatrics and child, adolescent, and adult psychiatry. He served as an NIMH research fellow at UCLA. He's currently an associate clinical professor of psychiatry at the UCLA School of Medicine, where he's also a co-investigator at the Center for Culture, Brain, and Development. And I think the work that you've been most excited about recently is being the executive director of the MindSight Institute, which is an educational organization focusing on how the development of insight, compassion, and empathy in individuals, families, and communities can be enhanced by examining the interface of human relationships and biological processes. And Dan is also the author of several wonderful books, one, The Developing Mind Toward a Neurobiology of Interpersonal Experience, another called Parenting from the Inside Out, and the latest book, The Mindful Brain, Reflection and Attunement in the Cultivation of Well-Being. So I'm just so happy to have you here, Dan.
Oh, thanks. Thanks a lot
Good.
For having me.
I had the pleasure of being with Dan at a recent meeting on the neuroscience of contemplative practices, and this is a field that is just expanding so much recently. And Dan, I wanted to start by just asking you about the word MindSight. I know that you have formed the MindSight Institute and you've done some writing about it. What is MindSight?
Well, MindSight is a term, you know, I coined years ago to try to express what we didn't seem to have in English, which was a word that says, how do we actually see the mind? How do we actually perceive the mind? So we can have insight into our own mind, we can have empathy that allows us to see other people's minds, but what's this general perceptual ability? And so MindSight really is about, on the surface level, how do we see our own mind and the mind of others? How do we have insight and empathy? But when we get deeper, we realize MindSight is this capacity to actually perceive energy and information flow as it rides along, for example, the waves of neural firing in the brain, or as it's happening between you and me right now in this conversation, or how it gets regulated, which is one way to define the mind itself. And so this perceptual ability, this ability to see energy and information flow, is really what MindSight is all about.
And in fact, that has been your definition of the word mind, which I think is really useful.
Yeah, you know, I was really struck in my own explorations in the last 10 years since that book, The Developing Mind, came out. You know, I had been never taught in my own training what the mind was, and then when I was writing that book, it came from working with a bunch of scientists who also didn't have a common definition of the mind. These were people, let's say, in anthropology or systems theory thinkers or people in neuroscience or developmental psychologists. So this definition of the mind as this embodied and relational process that regulates energy and information flow was what we used in this study group back in the beginning of the decade of the brain back in 1991. But then in 99, when I started giving lectures to mental health practitioners, I thought there would be a lot of different definitions of the mind, so I started asking people, but it turned out that well over 95% of mental health practitioners, now I've asked 77,000 of them all around the globe, well over 95% have not had a single lecture on what the mind is. And so this definition, it turns out, has been pretty useful as a starting place. It's a working definition, meaning we should be open to other ways of stating it or refining the definition. But it's been a useful place to start because it allows us to see that the mind is different from the brain, that the mind actually is a regulatory process, so it's like a verb, not a noun, and we can really dive deeply into what regulation means in terms of a process that lets you monitor something and then shape that thing. And so the monitoring and shaping components of regulation allow us to actually do something with, for example, developing mind sight, so you can actually have someone change their mind by the focus of their attention. And it just gives you a frame for then linking in all the exciting findings in neuroscience or the findings from social science and looking at the larger whole of our culture and our society, and just brings all that into kind of one frame of reference.
I know that you've talked quite a bit about reflection, and I might ask you more about that later, but I'm curious about how you see the mind being able to see itself. In other words, is the mind seeing itself from within itself? Is there anything other than brain and mind? Do you know what I am asking?
Yeah. No, I think it's a fantastic question, Cassie. And I don't pretend to be a philosopher to, ask the bigger questions about, the cosmos and everything like that. I'm, basically a scientist who's practicing full-time as a therapist and also now as an educator. So I'm not a philosopher. But in terms of the issue of reflection and how do we see our own minds, to start with the science part of that, this question has been so intriguing to me. I got a grant recently and brought in over a dozen scientists from all around the place, from different fields, to spend 3 days in a think tank just asking that very question you just asked. How do we as human beings see our own inner world? How do we see the mind? How do we do that? And so from an anthropologist's point of view, we had a number of anthropologists there, this question really allows us to look in the deep nature of culture. How do patterns of seeing the inner world get passed across the generations through ways that we communicate with each other? And that's what an anthropologist might be interested in. We also had quite a few neuroscientists there from the burgeoning field of social neuroscience. And there, we uncover all the exciting things about mirror neurons and the ways, in fact, that it looks like we've evolved as human beings to have this set of neurons that allows us to embed from the very beginning a way that we perceive patterns. And when these patterns have certain sequences to them that are predictable, there's a certain set of clusters in the brain called mirror neurons that bridge between seeing something or perceiving something and the motor action to create that same action. So this bridging between perception and motor function is quite fascinating when you look at brain structure, because they're usually in different areas of the brain, but it shows how these two anterior, the motor areas in the front, and posterior, it's perceptual area, go together. So there's an integrated functioning of front and back. But when you do that, basically, you're linking to another area of the brain that starts to create these neural representations that symbolize the intention of the person who you're perceiving. And it's a long-winded way of basically saying that we have neural structures that, by detecting predictable sequences, start making maps of the intentional state of another person. And this happens when a baby is born. This set of neurons, these mirror neurons and these superior temporal cortical neurons, actually are building maps of the mind, if you will, that is the first neural firing patterns that are symbolizing the mental state of someone else. And so from an evolutionary point of view, we probably have developed as social creatures initially the capacity to reflect, if you want to use that word, to process information on that allows us to be aware of, let's just say that's what reflection is, aware of the internal state of someone else. And so we actually know how the mirror neuron, superior temporal cortical area does that, and then it transfers these perceptual maps of another person's internal state down through an area of the brain called the insula, and then that drives the information to the lower areas, the subcortical areas of the limbic area, the brainstem, and even the body itself, the heart, the lungs, the intestines, and there's a resonating process of those subcortical areas that shifts their state, their subcortical activation, that then comes back up through the insula. And again, this long-winded answer is to say that this information of resonance that comes back up deposits itself almost like as if on a screen in the area of the brain just behind the forehead, this middle region of the frontmost part of the cortex called the prefrontal cortex. And that area then contains neural firing patterns that are embedding one's own internal state. And one of the things that came up at this think tank was the notion that the way we really come to see another person's mind is by detecting our own internal state, and we then create, in fact, images of our own mind through that internally reflective process. So that is probably the longest answer, Kathy, you'll ever get to an unbelievably simple question.
No, I think it's actually great. I mean, it opens up so many more questions, and one of the ways that I think I've heard you talk about it in the past, just to sort of ground some of what you were saying for some of our listeners, is it's almost like when I see you make the motion of picking up a glass of water to drink it, I can, the motor part of my brain that would drink a glass of water myself is activated. Is that true?
That's exactly
is that oversimplification?
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, I think we did that example at the Claremont conference we were at together, where, you know, if I just waved my hand and did a random motion, your brain wouldn't be able to detect my sequence because you wouldn't know what I was doing next. So this mirror neuron superior temporal cluster couldn't do its job of what's called, I call it SIMA, you know, the sensory implications of motor action. You would have no idea what the sensory implication was of my motor action. So you couldn't SIMA what I was doing. It would just be something you're perceiving, and your mirror neurons wouldn't get involved. But when you knew that my sequence had predictability to it, it would have predictability because you were detecting an implication of my motion and what it would mean for your sensory changes. That is, you could say, I'm lifting the cup here, and the cup will come closer, and then I'm going to lift it to my lips and drink. You would know that. And then the amazing thing about that, among many, many amazing things, is if you were seeing me drink, you would then get yourself ready to do the same thing. And as social creatures, it's how we resonate with each other in behavioral imitation. But it turns out that the mirror neurons and superior temporal area, they're not only involved in behavioral imitation, they're also involved, if you will, in, we'll make up a term, you know, internal imitation, which is something you call emotional resonance, where your internal state will become my internal state. And in a sense, the artificial boundaries that make you you and me dissolve, and it's really we.
Mm-hmm. Which is so interesting, because that's the subjective experience that so many people have in spiritual practices or mindfulness practices, non-dual states of awareness. And so there's some actual neural sort of truth to that subjective experience.
I think there's a deep neural truth, and I'm really new to this whole contemplative world. I mean, before 4 years ago, you know, this was like a totally unfamiliar territory for me, you know, in a formal way. So these have been an amazing 4 years in my own journey. But the thing you're saying about the neural reality of it is what's really exciting is to come trained in science and then look at this notion that the human brain has this tendency to create a delusion of our separateness. And I think part of what spiritual practices and again, I'm totally naive to them, I'm just learning about them, but from as an outsider, it feels like what's happening is that we've evolved with these brains that create this delusion of our separateness, and then there needs to be some kind of intentional practice to actually dissolve that delusion, or we continue to be imprisoned by it. And it's not that, you know, someone didn't have good parents, or, you know, society's a bad society or something like that. I mean, those two things may be true in certain situations, but it may be just a function of evolution that we've inherited these, if you will, these cortices, these six-layered thick cortex, which has this pattern of dominating our perceptual awareness. And this, I want to get back to your original question, is there something more about reflecting and reflecting? But just to talk about the cortex for a moment, you know, where you have these six layers, and incoming data comes in layer six, goes up to layer five, and moves up to layer four. But anything you've learned from the past comes from layer one and down to layer two and down to three, and it's kind of like waves crashing into each other, where three and four, if you will, metaphorically, they are crashing into each other. So if you and I are walking on the street, Cassie, and we see a furry animal that barks, you know, both of us can have in our cortex, you know, the perception of this dog. But if our top-down influence, that is, all the dogs we've ever seen in the category of dog and the word dog, come crashing down from layer one, two, and three and dominate our experience in the moment, then we're just going to say in our minds, if you will, dog, and move on. We won't really see that animal. We won't see that creature in front of us. And I think the same thing happens with a, quote, sense of isolated self, unquote, where the cortex, maybe in our society, maybe just because we're at in our, you know, cultural evolution, but the cortex now has these top-down influences which have the notion, maybe not a word, but it's certainly a notion of self. And so everything we experience then is experienced as if we're really separate from each other. And I think that's a cortical invention, because if you really look at energy and information flow as being these patterns that happen certainly in these resonating nodes that we call our bodies, but when you really let the body go as a way of defining the self, you realize energy and information flow happens all around us. And it passes through these boundaries of the body. And so to think we're separate just because we own different bodies, whatever own means, we live in different bodies, whatever live means, you know, is really a delusion. It's truly a delusion. So if we're seeing someone coming through a door, when we open the door for that person, we're opening the door for ourselves. That person is us, and we are them. And I'm not just saying that like to say it. I mean, I really think that's just the absolute truth. Only the cortex gets in the way of believing that. And of course, that leads to consumption and let me grab as much stuff as I can so I can have my stuff and, you know, accumulate until we're killing the planet. So this isn't just kind of philosophical discussion we're having. On some deep level, understanding these neural mechanisms and how to undo them might be a helpful place to begin in thinking about changing the path of human cultural evolution.
Yeah, I agree with that completely, and I think that's right in line with what most of the members of the Institute of Noetic Sciences are here for, and what most of our listeners are really interested in. And it just seems like the implications of what you're saying are so large in both positive and negative ways. So there's the way that, I guess what Bowlby would have called a schema, you know, is sort of hardwired. So all the experiences you've had influence the way that you perceive the intention of another person, for example. And as you were saying with the dog example, it's unfortunately not always really what's happening in the present moment that we're basing our responses on, but this whole sort of representational world. And if the representational world has been negatively influenced, or, you know, from a fearful worldview or a materialist, you know, hyper-materialist worldview, that has one set of implications. And then if it has had other experiences, that has a whole other set of implications.
Absolutely.
And I know a lot of your work is kind of focused on not only what, how that has worked in early childhood and during infancy, but also later in life and the ways that people heal as adults, whether or not they've been through very difficult experiences or not. Could you speak a little bit more to the kind of malleability of this whole system?
Yeah, no, I think that's you know, well said, and I'm really interested in you know, how this organization is actually interested in these things, because, you know, for me, I come from exactly what you're saying, you know, more a developmental place. I mean, I was originally in pediatrics and then, you know, went into psychiatry and child psychiatry because I really wanted to know, you know, how do people become who they become, and wanted to know, you know, about health, but, of course, in the psychiatry world, you know, all about illness and defining symptoms and trying to alleviate that suffering, which is important. But what was frustrating to me as a psychiatrist, and then, and now I learn as, you know, just a member of the mental health community, is, you know, we just didn't define what the mind itself was, let alone what a healthy mind was. So in my own training, I wanted to know about these early factors, whether they're genetic factors or, you know, somatic factors or experiential factors. What were the elements that went into people becoming who they became? And so I got myself a research fellowship to actually study that. And, you know, the field of psychology, which is so beautiful looking into this stuff, is the field of attachment research. And so I became an attachment researcher and then, you know, found my my heart was really in being a therapist, working one-on-one with people to help them in the process of change. And so I've applied what I learned as trained as a scientist in the practice of psychotherapy over these last, whatever, it's been 20 years. And, you know, I've been so, feel so grateful that these two worlds could come together. So, you know, I can give you a whole thing on, you know, what does the science of attachment say, but I think that maybe the more useful place to start is saying that there's this idea of consilience, that there's a way of, resilience means pulling together the findings from different efforts to understand truth into one view. And so that effort, you know, from clinical work, from developmental science work, from just being a person on the planet, from different fields of science, you know, I put together in this thing with colleagues called interpersonal neurobiology. And there we really study this question you're asking of, you know, what are the experiential factors, genetic factors, and other factors that allow us to see how people develop. And so in my own view of interpersonal neurobiology, we have, you know, a dozen textbooks now out through Norton for professionals to look into the science of all this. So I'll just give you the highlights. But in my own use of it, I talk about this triangle of mind, brain, and relationships to understand these developmental questions so that the mind, as we mentioned, is, you know, this process that can be defined as that which regulates energy and information flow. Relationships is how we share energy and information flow, like between me and you right now. And the brain is this term just to mean the larger extended nervous system distributed throughout the whole body, so not just in the skull, but we'll use the word brain anyway, that the brain is the neural mechanism of this flow. Then you say, well, how do experiences, let's say, in a baby's young life, let's say in the first year of life, shape the emerging connections of the basic cell and the nervous system, the neuron, to each other. And through a whole bunch of studies, and these are all in the textbooks, you know, that we have a dozen textbooks with thousands of scientific references. So what I'm going to say may sound like hooey, and you say, well, that's just woo-woo stuff, but you know, I can now say it this way because, you know, we have all these publications out there. What I believe happens, based on science, is that when parents have energy and information flow that's shared in a way which is attuned and resonant, what happens is that this way of honoring the autonomy of the child while linking to them is a part of a process called integration, the linkage of differentiated things of the parts of the system is called integration. So when in attachment study, the way of interpreting them, even though they don't talk about integration, the larger view, I think, is to take those attachment studies and say, what promotes a healthy development trajectory for a child? And it's when integration is what's happening. Now, the energy information flow of honoring differences and linking them, when a parent's tuned in and empathic and sensitive and all that wonderful stuff, when that happens and when there are ruptures to that, it's repaired. When those things all happen, the fibers in the child's brain that link differentiated areas to each other, and hence we call them integrative fibers, those fibers are the ones that grow. And when you look at the actual neuroanatomy, which is hard to do on a phone without, you know, doing some demonstrations in your hand or on a drawing, but when you look at the anatomical structures of the brain and how they're differentiated, that is, you have different areas that are separate and they're specialized, and then ask the question, which of the fibers that actually, which of the fibers are actually performing this integrative function, that is, linking the different areas to each other, you find, in fact, that those are the exact areas that are promoted in healthy development. And when there's severe forms of non-healthy development, like abuse and neglect, those are the exact areas that are malformed. So we have this piece of, you know, consilient view, which says integrative communication promotes the growth of integrative neural fibers in the brain. And then you could say, well, all right, assuming Dan is accurate in this consilient view, taking these different sciences and putting them into one whole elephant view of the whole thing, then why would integration be a good thing? And then when you look at the mathematics of the complexity theory, you actually get one view of why integration would be a good thing, and it means that in systems that are capable of complex behavior, that is, they're capable of chaos and they're open, these are called complex systems, when they're integrated, they have a very special flow. The self-organizational movement of a complex system tends to move toward this weird thing called maximizing complexity, and when it does, it's actually integrating its functioning, and it's moving in a flexible and adaptive way. And that's, I think, a pretty wonderful definition of well-being. And so in this interpersonal neurobiology view, what we propose is that integration is at the heart of health. That integration is what parents do with children to help their brains develop well, which in our view means develop integrative fibers. As those children grow, they can become a part of society where they can go hopefully beyond themselves and start to give back to society, which clearly would be an example of an integrative function, you know, taking your separate self and linking it to others, rather than just isolating yourself and accumulating stuff. So in all these ways, you can go and look at, you know, the individual neural connections, especially the ones that are just behind the forehead, these middle prefrontal areas, and you can go out in society and say, you know, how do we promote integrative functioning? And so when you look at, you know, how to transform the United States or how to think about the global world we live in, these concepts of integration don't stay alone within just brain science or attachment science. They have implications for, you know, how the individuals that comprise families and comprise communities can actually take a very different stance on how energy and information is flowing. And when it's integrative, I think we're going to see a lot of changes in how our societies function. So I'm talking for a long time. So I
No, it's very good. I think it seems like it's such a good framework also for viewing how some of the activities and practices that people can engage in as adults can also sort of reintegrate or even newly integrate in the same way. And it seems like some of the science of meditative practices is pointing towards a similar kind of integration, maybe in some of the same brain areas that's happening through that process. And potentially psychotherapy is aiding in this kind of integration. And one of the things that I think I really have liked about your recent writings is this very accessible acronym COLE, and I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, well, first of all, that's beautiful what you're saying, and I appreciate that notion, which I think is really exciting, that, you know, the neural circuits of contemplative practice are also integrative, and there's these parallel findings, let's say, between secure attachment, contemplative practice, and the notion that we're kind of becoming attuned in this integrative way. You know, in terms of the acronym, I also appreciate that you like the acronym. I don't know why my brain does it, but it sort of comes up with these acronyms, and then I just kind of can't get them out of my head. But I think, you know, half the people, I don't know if it's half, but some people who read the stuff hate the acronyms. They will write me emails and say, stop doing the acronyms. I don't like them. They're irritating. And I'm just finishing up a book actually called Mindsight now, and, you know, I've got a few acronyms in there, and, you know, I take to heart all these emails I get, so I'm trying not to put them in, but I love them, and COLE is one of them. Just today, I was finishing up a chapter, and there was this section with COLE, and I was debating whether to not put it in or put it in, so I'm happy to talk about it, and I'm also, you know, struggling with whether, you know, how do you actually make everybody happy?
Yeah,
acronyms and some don't.
Yeah, I mean, I think just as an aside to that conversation,
yeah.
Particularly for people who are trying to use this in their lives, I think it's really useful because what tends to happen during distressing moments when somebody gets lost, or I think you've said in some of your writings, when you sort of start to take the low road rather than the high road, that you forget. You know, you forget what your overriding intention was, and you forget where you were coming from. And these kinds of acronyms, I think, in people's lives can be really helpful because you think, wait a minute, what was all that stuff about compassion again?
Yeah.
Because I can't quite grasp it at this moment when I'm being triggered by something in my environment, whether that's a trigger from personal trauma or that's just a trigger of evolutionary hardwiring for fight or flight or whatever it is. So
exactly.
That would be my pitch for the acronym.
Good. I'm gonna put that in my head and try to hold on to them. COLE is one, in teaching mindfulness practices now in therapy. I mean, we have our research center at UCLA that I help co-direct where we're doing that there. But in private practice, you know, I'm teaching people, let's say, to meditate. I want to give them a way of being kind to themselves, and COLE just came up in talking to a patient one day, you know, about the kind of, you know, what kind of stance do you take, let's say, just with mindfulness of the breath, when you get distracted, and the task is to notice you're distracted and lovingly, gently, kindly return your attention to the breath. And this was a person who was particularly tough with herself, and so I made up this COLE thing, and I said, you know, you're going to be curious and open and accepting of what's there. You know, that's mindfulness and everything, but you're going to be loving, you know, and you can take this positive stance. You know, so, and COLE was a word you could say, you know, and then I made up something like it's the COLE that warms the heart of change or something ridiculous like that. And she's like, you know, otherwise, you know, what is COLE? A big bunch of, you know, hard stuff. So it doesn't really go along with something warm and fuzzy, but warm heart of change, that helped with her. So she likes COLE, and, you know, other people have wanted me to put an equal sign in there saying, you know, curiosity, openness, and acceptance equals love, and I think that's nice, too. So however people can use it, I'm happy about that. And, you know, so COLE is this notion that I think you can take a very kind and accepting and gentle inner stance with yourself. If you want to come back to those six-layered cortical thinkings, it's where that you allow the top-down influences to be filled with a sense of acceptance and compassion, rather than what a lot of us have is, you know, some harsh critical voice that says, you know, do it right, you got to do it right in school, and now you're meditating and you got distracted, you're doing it wrong. And, you know, that's easy to fall back on the harshness and the kind of competitive, academic-oriented, you know, upbringing a lot of us have just going to elementary school. So I thought COLE would be a nice way to start someone, you know, on the journey to kindness, which in the end, you know, if you had to say what's the ultimate outcome of integration, you know, and all this other stuff, it really does, I think, come down to kindness. That if this kindness inside, which COLE, you know, represents, you know, kindness for others, you know, which is what compassion represents, you know, that's the thing to remember, you know, and we don't even need an acronym for it. You know, we just have the word. But that's basically what COLA was all about.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, when I brought that up, it wasn't totally non sequitur. It was really about not only the fact that those are outcomes, but also that those practices are cultivators of integration. So
yeah.
The way that one can view sort of what were previously automatic processes and now are actually being viewed with the searchlight of attention, but you know, it has to have that curiosity, openness, and acceptance. I think there's probably some neural process happening there where the that particular way of paying attention with that intention of being curious and open and accepting and loving toward experience as much as possible, I imagine, and I think there's a little bit of evidence starting to show that it does promote integration, or at least it promotes maybe some growth of those parts of the brains that are sort of the peacemakers, so to speak, or the bridging, well, those bridging axons. You know, sometimes when I think about this stuff, it's probably a total oversimplification, but I actually can envision, you know, those axons growing bridges between the part of the brain that's sort of watching and attending with this curiosity and openness and acceptance, and then those sort of previously, those what you were saying, sort of those rigid, locked-in pieces that, you know, over time, gradually, we break up through our practices. And
right, right. Well, you know, I think that you're saying a couple of really, I think, intriguing and important things. The first thing I want to respond to is the notion that, you know, Cole is both an outcome and a practice that generates the outcome. And that's the amazing thing about integration, is you see this reverberating, self-reinforcing loop, and MindSight certainly is that way too. You know, when you follow energy and information flow in this open kind of way, it creates more openness, you know, and more MindSight. The more MindSight you do, the more MindSight you get. Same thing with Cole, you know, it's, we do the practice that generates the outcome of the practice, that then doing more of it generates more of it. And I think,
which makes research really hard.
Yeah, totally. I really feel for you. It's why I do, you know, teaching and practice primarily these days. So, you know, for me, you know, that reinforcing thing fits totally with the mathematics of coherence. You know, there's this whole really interesting, if you like math, study of coherence versus cohesion. And a cohesive set of equations kind of, you know, the equations say, okay, if you're an odd number, you're in our group, and if you're an even number, you're out. And it doesn't matter what happens in the flow of this system, you're either in or you're out, depending on if you're even or you're odd. And that's a cohesive equation. Instead, a coherent equation embeds the things it's considering, the factors it's considering, this number. It embeds that number into its own equation, so it's constantly changing and evolving in this flexible way, so that the very act of doing its equationoid thing actually changes the equation and changes the definition of the set it's trying to define. And so what we see in that concept, that mathematical concept of coherence, is this self-reinforcing process when we add the self-organizational principles of complexity. Then we understand that, in fact, these self-reinforcing, liberating stances are, I think, freeing up the system's natural self-organizational movement toward integration. And a lot of times, I think what happens is there's something that gets in its way. For example, I think the human cortex gets in its own way. Mm-hmm. I think that's why we're prone to trauma, and it's why we're prone to doing all these horrible things to each other. Our cortex is not able to deal with a lot of the subcortical stuff that's driving it. And that combination of ancient history and modern cortical abilities doesn't work very well, so we create these huge instruments of destruction, and we don't have the wisdom to actually deal with it. You know, and that's an example of something that's getting in our way. So I think contemplative practices, or whatever you want to call them, spiritual practices, they have the promise, I think, of finding out where these obstacles are to a natural healing movement, a natural way where, whether it's groups of people or an individual life or families, you know, I think there's a natural drive toward integration, which I think is basically synonymous with healing and health, and in fact wholeness, which I think are all derivatives of the same terms. And this kind of liberation requires that we try to take the pulse of integration so we can know, for example, we can know when the system is moving toward either rigidity or toward chaos, which are the two states that a complex system moves to when it's not integrated. Mm-hmm. And the thing in between chaos and rigidity, this flowing movement, is really, you could call, harmony. And that flexible state is maximizing complexity. It's integrated. It's a harmonious flow. And so I think what we're kind of talking about is that. So that's the first thing of what you said. The second thing was about just, you know, the notion of, well, where do we go with this? How do we actually, you know, turn this into things that are useful for people, you know, like acronyms like COLE or whatever. And I think there's an opportunity now in our evolving global culture to raise awareness about, you know, I mean, I call it mindsight, but probably everyone has a different name for it, but, you know, this awakening of the mind to the fact that we have a choice, that we have a choice on how we allow our automaticity to keep us in this numbed out, you know, materialistic driven, acquisition oriented way of being, or we have this opportunity to actually awaken the mind with a certain kind of intentional effort. And it seems like all around in different areas of our culture, political, you know, artistic, scientific, clinical, educational, you know, there's this opportunity to realize that if we just go on automatic pilot, we're going to drive ourselves to extinction. But in fact, we're at a turning point where we can turn the tide toward a state of awakening where, from a brain point of view, we're actually taking these top-down influences and we can allow ourselves to free ourselves up from the prison that they create. And that prison is both on an individual basis and a collective basis. And I think it's really doable. I'm an optimist. I had, you know, I have B positive blood, and I was born on Hope Street and, you know, weighed 7-Eleven. So I have all these positive aspects to my background. And I'm probably a perennial, I'm just a continual optimist. But I think there's a reality behind it. It's just not just a defense.
Yeah, well, one of the things I've liked to play with is the idea that up until recently, evolution has been random, and now we're in some ways being invited to participate in the process of evolution in a conscious way.
So
I'd love to get out of the way now, because I know we've probably got several listeners who are brimming with questions, so that is, we're going to open up the lines to listeners to ask some questions over the next 15 minutes.
Great. Well, Cassie, let me thank you for this great set of questions and fun conversation.
Oh, you're so welcome, and I'll be here listening, yeah.
Great. Thanks.